They drove through the dark. Court began feeling better, the pain medicine and the blood and the sugar water boosting his strength and spirits. They discussed the procedure, and Justine took several minutes to ready her sutures and bandages on the dashboard in front of her. She cringed as she threaded the razor-sharp hooked needle and dipped it in a bottle of antiseptic, laid it down on sterile gauze. She opened his shirt and cut off his bandages and poured half the contents of the bottle on his stomach, and he recoiled from the sting. They both unfastened their seatbelts, and she rose to her knees in the passenger seat. Gentry put his hands high on the wheel to allow her access to his belly. He gulped down the last few swigs of cold coffee and tossed the cup over his shoulder into the back. Justine then used adhesive tape to fasten Court's small flashlight to the bottom of the steering wheel, lighting the area of her focus perfectly as long as she was careful to keep her hands from casting shadows over the stab wound.
"I have never done this before on a human, even in the correct conditions, but I have sutured cats before."
"You will do fine," Court said. He realized they were both trying to steady the nerves of the other. But Justine's resolve faltered first. She looked up at the American and asked,
"Are you sure? I will have to go deep into the muscle to close the wound. If I just pierce the skin, it will tear as soon as you move."
Court nodded, his eyes already watering in anticipation of the agony. "Justine," he said softly, "whatever I say or do, do not stop." She nodded, steeled herself.
"Are you ready?"
He nodded shortly, pulled his seatbelt off his chest, and placed it in his mouth. He bit down hard. The roadway ran flat and straight, and the headlamps showed the way. Justine pierced her patient's flesh a half inch from the bloody knife wound. The hooked needle found its own path deep through his abdominal muscle. It passed through the slit, and fresh blood bubbled into the flashlight's beam. The curvature of the sharp spike sent it back out of his skin, a half inch on the other side of the stab wound. Court screamed into the seatbelt wedged in his mouth. Justine took the thread with her gloved hand, pulled the instrument backwards the way it came, and re-threaded the needle. Even with a quarter dose of morphine going through her patient, she felt his teardrops on her arms as she made her second suture, close to the first. For 10 kilometers she continued. She did not look away from her work as she sewed him up, but she spoke to him in soothing French throughout, just as she would an injured dog. Above her, her patient winced and groaned. Miraculously, to her way of thinking, he continued to drive, execute gentle turns as needed, once even braking slightly. Justine assumed the road ahead and his need to concentrate on it was the only thing keeping him coherent. She used gauze to swab away the blood as she worked, poured antiseptic from the bottle she'd staged between his legs to get a better view of the pumping wound. Finally, she said,
"Almost done. I only have to pull it tight and tie it off. Just a few more seconds now."
Above her, she heard him panting and sobbing. There was a rhythm to his sounds that distressed her. She knew he could go into shock at any time.
"Here we go. I will be as gentle as possible."
She pulled on the thread, and the wound closed beautifully, and the last of the bleeding stopped immediately.
"Yes, perfect. Now I just tie it and..."
The tires below her ran over a series of bumps. The Mercedes suspension was awesome. She barely felt the rough surface. But when the bumps did not stop after several seconds, she looked up to check on her patient. She was horrified to see his head hanging down just above her, his eyes closed. Jim had passed out. The black Mercedes ran off the road and crashed at 5:30 a.m. Chapter 31 All 10 Belarusian guards were on station around the property, 6 outside, 2 at ground floor windows, and 2 in the tower above. Serge and Elaine, the 2 electronic security engineers, sat in the ground floor library, their bloodshot eyes scanning back and forth across the screens, watching the infrared images around the perimeter of the building. Every 5 minutes, they used walkie-talkies to communicate with the patrols. The Libyans were the only hunter-killer squad still in the area. They fought exhaustion as their van patrolled Bayou. They were certain by now they were out of the big money. The other teams who had been in the area had since been sent to Paris to search for the target, as had every pavement artist within 300 miles. The Libyans had been given a clear chance at the target back on the hillside in Switzerland, and they had failed. So now they were ordered to sit tight and wait. We're facing 100-to-1 odds at best they would get another crack at the Gray Man. No one expected Gentry to make it to Bayou now. Regal, Lloyd, the tech, and Felix sat in the control room in low light, sipped coffee, and watched computer monitors displaying the rocking and bouncing images broadcast from digital video cameras held by watchers and kill teams in Paris. The tech was still organizing the search around the Seine. By now, Regal and Lloyd both conceded Gentry must have made it out of the water downstream and staggered off, so the net was widened, and then widened again on both sides of the river. By 5:30 a.m., there was fresh news in Paris that generated a flurry of activity around the chateau. A watcher listening to police radio had learned about a break-in at a minor emergency clinic in the 5th arrondissement. This was upstream from where the target went into the river, but the tech had sent a watcher over to find out what he could. The owners of the clinic had arrived and announced the medicines and blood and equipment stolen were all items necessary for wound management. Regal stood behind the tech.
"We'll have to split the search. Keep the Bolivians and the Sri Lankans in Paris. Tell the Botswanans to come here via the highway. See if they can spot him on the way. Send a helicopter up to pick up the Kazakhs. They are the most skilled gunners. I want them here. They can patrol the back roads around the property, checking anything that moves, and alert the Libyans in Bayou. They need to stay there to watch the train station and the routes through town. If the Gray Man is somehow still in the fight, he'll be here before daybreak."
The tech muttered to himself. "We bloody saw him. We bloody well saw him hurt. We bloody well saw him fall into the water."
Lloyd slapped him on the back of the head as he stormed out of the room, heading downstairs to tell the men monitoring the infrared cameras that their target may be on the way.
"Please, please, Jim, you must wake!"
Court Gentry opened his eyes. Above him, a figure loomed close in the dark. Instinctively, he reached out and took the figure's neck and grabbed it tight and slammed it to the ground next to him as he tried to roll on top of it. Court fell on Justine in the tall, wet grass.
"Sorry,"
was all he could say as he climbed off of the French girl. He moved sluggishly, his body clearly impeded by drugs. She was slow to get up as well. It was dark, and he could make out her wide eyes best of all. She sat up next to him, finally, and he looked away uncomfortably. He took stock of his surroundings. He was seated in wet grass, both of their backs leaned against the Mercedes. They were in a field, the black sedan 4/5 through a thicket. Gentry assumed the road was on the other side. The glow of the moon was diffused by the mist above him, but he could make out the lumbering movement of cows in the muddy field near the car. The air was cold.
Where are we?" "I could not wake you. We are west of Cannes, still 30 minutes from Bayeux."
"Shit. What time is it?"
The American slowly remembered his mission, as if it appeared from out of the fog of his drug-addled brain.
"It is almost 7. The sun will be up in under an hour."
"We crashed, didn't we?"
"No, monsieur. We did not crash. You crashed."
It was coming back to him, but slowly. He put his hand down to his injured belly, though it was barely hurting at the moment. He wore a clean brown shirt. Through it, he could feel bandages cinched tight. He looked down at his new pants.
"You dressed me?"
Justine looked away, out to the dark field.
"I found the clothes in a bag in the car, after the wreck."
"Are you hurt?"
he asked.
"Not bad. Some bruises. We were lucky. You ran off the road onto a cow path through the hedgerow. We crashed through these trees. The car is stuck. After the wreck, I gave you a little medicine, bandaged you, and dressed you. We have been here ever since. A little while ago, a helicopter flew over. It scared me. I thought maybe they are looking for us.
Court's head was clearing by the second. He was back with it now. I'll never make it in time.
You told me 8 a.m. We can still make it before then.
I needed to be in position before the sun came up. Gentry sighed. Let it go. He stood slowly, found it less difficult than he expected. What did you give me?
I gave you some painkillers, and I put bandages very tight around your waist to lower the pain.
Gentry was checking the wrappings through the shirt as she spoke.
Good. I don't feel too bad.
It won't last. The pain will return soon. I did not give you the other drug, the dextrostat. I read the bottle. It is a very strong amphetamine. If you take one of those pills, your blood pressure will increase. If my stitches are not perfect, you will bleed very badly. You could bleed internally as well. It would be crazy for you to swallow one of those pills.
I'm not going to swallow one of the pills. I'm going to break open three of them, pour the contents into a cup of hot coffee. That will break down the time-release coating, so I will get all of the effect instantly.
That is suicide,
she said.
I am not a doctor, but I know what that will do to your body.
This will help me stay sharp for a half hour or so. If I bleed out after that, well, that's okay. I just have to do my job first.
She began to protest, but he interrupted her.
We need new transport, something local, something that will not draw attention.
Justine shook her head in frustration.
There is a farmhouse just over there. Maybe you can borrow their vehicle.
Court looked around the side of the hedgerow to the farmhouse, 75 yards away. Already, a light was on in the window. An old white four-door, splattered waist-high with mud and manure, sat outside glowing in the window's light.
Yeah, I'll go borrow their vehicle.
He reached slowly into the trunk of the Mercedes and retrieved the second Glock pistol, the first he had lost in the Paris passageway. Without looking, he pulled back the slide an inch and used a finger to make sure the gun was loaded.
I'll be right back.
In the last hour before dawn, Regal had the entire force at the chateau at full battle stations, because he fully expected the Grey Man to come then, if he was to come at all. The 10 gunmen from Minsk were divided into 3 groups of 2, patrolling the garden and driveway to the main gate, their Kalashnikov battle rifles in hand. 2 more manned AK-47s on the first floor of the chateau. One watched out a window to the drive, and the other a window towards the garden in the back. The final 2 Belarusians were in the chateau's turret above, one sniper with a Dragunov-scoped rifle, the same man and the same weapon used to end the life of Philip Fitzroy, and one spotter who wore an AR-15 on his back and looked out in all directions into the night with binoculars. In addition to the 10 Belarusians were Lloyd's 3 men from London, the Northern Irishman and the 2 Scots. The Northern Irishman now lay discarded in the basement next to Philip's body. 2 were in the kitchen, radios in their ears and submachine guns in their laps, waiting in reserve to be sent by Regal himself to wherever the Grey Man appeared. The 3rd, McSpadden, was in the hall outside of the second-floor bedroom covering the Fitzroy family. There were also the 2 French engineers in the first-floor library, watching over the monitors of the infrared cameras positioned around the yard. These were both ex-infantrymen in their 40s. They wore pistols on their hips and knew how to use them. Finally, there was the tech, Lloyd, Felix, and Regal in the control room. Of the 4, only Regal could be considered a real gunfighter. He wore his pistol in a shoulder holster underneath his suede jacket. Dangerous to others or not, Lloyd was armed with his small automatic, and a charged Uzi had been placed on the tech's computer desk, though the ponytailed Brit had never before been so close to a loaded weapon. This made the odds 19 defenders versus 1 attacker, but this was merely the inner line of coverage around the chateau. The 4 Libyan Jamahiriya Security Organization operatives were in constant radio contact with the tech, 10 kilometers away in Bayou. They watched the road from town to the chateau and the soon-to-open train station, the only reasonable route from Paris. The sleek, black Eurocopter flew lazy eights at high altitude, carrying the five Saudis. The chopper watched the roads down from Cannes to the east and even along the coast to the north in case the gray man magically appeared on a Normandy beach like a one-man replay of the D-Day invasion. And the four Kazakhs, just in from Paris, patrolled in a small blue Citroën, their Kalashnikovs in their laps with the stocks folded. They drove through the countryside, pulled up behind early rising drivers, and checked their plates, shone bright lights into cars to scan the vehicle's occupants. The Kazakhs did not use their radios. Yes, they listened into the text communication with the other teams, but they never acknowledged or responded to the text calls for them to check in. They were there to kill the gray man and make the money and go home. They would communicate with the men in the chateau only when they dumped Gentry's body at the front gate and demanded their money. Regal oversaw the entire operation from the third-floor control room. He'd been the first to admit it was no fair fight, more than 30 armed men against one horribly wounded adversary who was operating with limited resources and little sleep. But Regal was a hunter, and a fair fight was not his game. Chapter 32. The early morning glow shone off the English Channel, and a hint of the morning's first hues brushed the back of Justine's shoulders as she drove the dirty white four-door west along the coastal road. She kept to the marked speed limit, read the signs carefully. Her passenger seat and her back seat were empty, except for several aluminum suitcases. She motored alone, made a left in the coastal village of Longsumer, did not speed up or slow down when a black helicopter swooped a couple hundred feet above her. It made a second pass and then a third before disappearing from her view, heading to the southwest. She had the road all to herself for a while. But not long after the helicopter's departure, a blue Citroën pulled behind her from a gravel lane to her left, dust and exhaust rising behind it. She chanced a glance into a rear view and saw nothing but bright headlights. They stayed close behind her for several hundred meters, and then the car pulled alongside. Justine gripped the thin steering column so hard she thought it would break off in her hands as a flashlight beam illuminated her. Then scanned around behind her in the back seat. Then the light turned off. The Citroën pulled ahead of her, and she was certain she would see its brake lights come on, forcing her to stop. But the car sped away. Its taillights disappeared in the mist ahead after another minute. After heading south for a few kilometers, she looked down at the map in her lap, noted the pencil marks Jim had put there for her. There was a left turn ahead, and she took it after flipping off her lights. The narrow road ran straight. Thick hedgerows reached high on each side of her. After 3 minutes of driving through the darkness, the road turned to the south, but she slowed, bumped the little car off the pavement, and revved the engine just enough to send it into a deep thicket. A large stone wall rose from the ground on the other side of the thicket, 3 meters high. From her view, it filled the windshield and seemed to reach up into the infinite sky. She bumped the sedan's front bumper against it and turned off the engine. It was nearly pitch dark here, with the high trees on either side of the narrow road. Quickly, she climbed from the driver's seat. She was careful not to slam the door behind her. She knocked 4 times slowly on the trunk of the Fiat, a prearranged signal that all was well. A moment later, the trunk lid lifted. Jim looked up at her from his tight squeeze inside, an empty paper coffee cup by his side, and a black rifle in his arms. "No problems?" he asked as he slowly climbed out. She could see the pain on his face that came with the movement's effect on his injuries. He left the rifle in the trunk of the car, walked around to the side, stretching out after suffering the cramped confines of the trunk.
"There are men around, in a car and in a helicopter. I am sure there are more inside the property. They must think you are a very dangerous man to have so many people waiting for you,
Justine said as she stood behind the car in the road. The American had pushed through the tall bushes on the passenger side to pull open the door to the back seat. My reputation is exaggerated.
What?
Never mind. I want to thank you for all you've done. You've earned every cent of that money. I could not have done this without you. Justine smiled in the low light.
You haven't really done anything yet, Jim.
That's a fair point.
How do you feel?
She asked. Like I just downed a triple dose of speed with a double espresso. Your stitches are holding fine. Without warning, a car's headlights raked over Justine's body. She turned to look to the light, then quickly she spun back to look to Jim for guidance, but he was gone. Seconds later, the blue Citroën pulled to a stop behind her, and four men quickly climbed out. Justine stood in the bright light and raised a hand up to shield her eyes. The light washed over her, and she felt naked in the bright beams. The four men moved in front of the lights and were silhouetted in them. She saw the profiles of long guns in the men's arms. Someone shouted at her, but she did not understand, and she could not speak. Instead, she looked to her left and to her right, into the pre-dawn's dimness all around. Somewhere in the safety, away from the shafts of light, she knew Jim had run away and gotten free from the men in front of her. She thought he must have somehow made it over the stone wall. He'd left her here to explain the trunks of equipment in the car and to come up with some plausible reason she should be here right now. The terror in her body threatened to burst her heart open inside her chest.
Bonjour,
she said to the four silhouettes, her meek voice little more than a whimper. The figures moved closer to her as one, guns still pointed forward. 15 meters, 10 meters. The shadows converged as they closed. Then, the steady movement forward of the silhouettes changed suddenly. A fast shadow from the left, a profile turned towards the movement, the shape of a long gun beginning to rise, and then a cry of surprise from the specters in front of her as one tall figure crumpled into a ball. Quickly she backed up, bumped into the trunk of the car, watched the dancing movement of light and dark in front of her. Through the confusion on the road, she distinguished the outlines of arms and legs as punches rained down and kicks flew. Guns spun free through the air and clanked to the dusty gravel amid the shouts and cracks of fists on flesh and bone on bone. A second figure dropped and stilled, this one flat under the headlights' beams. She saw that it was not Jim. More convergence of shadows in the rising dust cloud, and a man's outline wrapped its dark appendages around the head and neck of another profile and spun, lifted the silhouette off the pavement, and Justine heard the snap of a neck as cervical vertebrae shattered from obscene torsion. Justine had seen fistfights on television action shows. This was nothing of that. The movements were faster, more brutal, crueler. There was no ballet or poetry in the relationship between the adversaries, no choreography. No, it was unyielding surface on unyielding surface, the jerking reactions and the grunts and cries of wild beasts, labored breathing from exertion and panic. The sounds of cracking impacts and the frenzy of a combat so pitiless, she was sure all the men would tear to pieces in the street in front of her. Three men were down now, and a fourth ran out of the shafts of light to go for a rifle that had fallen and skidded free of the fight. Justine saw Jim now as he pursued in the dusty street and knocked the other man down from behind. Blows were exchanged by each, and Jim was thrown flat on his back in the cold road. Quickly, the Frenchwoman turned to the truck to lift the rifle the American had left there, though she had no idea how to turn it on so that she could use it. As she looked away from the fight, she heard a sick cry of pain. She hefted the big gun and turned back to find Jim up on his knees and the fourth man rolling away from him, hands over his eyes. Jim regained his feet, bringing a long gun up with him and then over his head. While Justine watched, Jim beat the writhing man with the butt end of the gun. One after another, like an axe chopping wood, the blows fell onto the struggling man's back. His hands raised in defense, but the rifle's butt beat its way to the horror-stricken eyes. The eyes erupted in blood, and his jaw broke and hung open, sickeningly.
It must have taken a dozen merciless blows to the crushed head to still the man on his back in the cold road, and Justine could not look away.
Slowly, when it was all over, the Frenchwoman slid down the bumper of the car to the ground. She laid the rifle in front of her, and her empty hands shook as she covered her face and cried. Court fought hyperventilation as he cleared the four bodies from the road. He heard a helicopter above in the lightning morning. With the hedgerows on both sides and the high wall surrounding Chateau Laurent, the chopper would have to fly directly above to spot his position, but Gentry knew every second he stayed exposed on the dusty road was a gamble. Quickly, he checked the trunk of the car for any equipment he could put to use. Immediately, he found four sets of level 3A body armor, all but worthless against a rifle-caliber bullet, but damn effective stopping pistol fire. Quickly, he pushed his head through a vest and velcroed the side panels tightly around his waist. Also in the back were hard-shell tactical knee and elbow pads. He put these on as well, figured a scuffed elbow would be the absolute least of his many worries in the next few minutes, but there was no sense leaving an ounce of protective gear behind. Then he sat down in the driver's seat of the little Citroën, shoved it in gear to drive into the thick hedgerow in an attempt to conceal it from the air. Looking down, he realized he'd popped some, if not all, of the sutures Justine had used to tie his stomach back together. His knife wound bled and wet his bandages and his shirt under the bulletproof vest. Blood trickled out of his stomach, down his pants, and onto the car seat. "Shit," he said aloud. Once again, he was operating on borrowed time. After hiding the bodies and the car and tossing the AKs into the bushes, he went to Justine, who was still kneeling by the car. She wiped tears and strands of tousled hair from her eyes. Slowly she rose to her feet. She looked towards the bodies poorly concealed in the bushes. Discarded, arms and legs splayed unnaturally.
"They were bad men, yes?"
"Very bad. I had to do it, and now I have to go over that wall and do it some more." Justine did not respond. Court began opening the aluminum cases, cinching a utility belt tightly around his waist, hooking the drop-leg pistol holder on his right thigh and the subload magazine carrier on his left. "I'm out of time. I have to go." He slung the M4 assault rifle over his neck and left arm and fastened the small HK MP5 submachine gun, muzzle down, to the vest on the chest rig he'd taken from the blue Citroën. He slid the Glock 19 pistol into the thigh holster and velcroed the two fragmentation grenades into place on the vest. From the front seat of the car, he took the satellite phone and jammed it into his hip pocket. In just under 3 minutes, he was ready. He turned back to Justine, who stood silently behind him, still looking at the exposed legs of the four shattered corpses. "I'll need to use the hood of the car to climb over the fence. Once I clear the top, I want you to back up, turn around, drive back up the coast. Go west, not east. Park this car at the next train station you see. Get on the first morning train to Paris and go home. Thank you again for everything you've done for me." Justine's eyes were distant. Gentry knew killing the four men in hand-to-hand combat right in front of her had shaken her badly. It would upset anyone, he thought, at least any normal person who did not live his life. "Are you going to be okay?" he asked gently.
"Are you a bad man, Jim?"
she asked, her pupils still wide from the fight. He put his hand on her arm, held it gently if uncomfortably. "I don't think so. I've been taught some bad things. I do some bad things, but only to bad people."
"Yes,"
she said. She seemed to clear a little.
"Yes."
She looked up at him.
"I wish you luck."
"Maybe when I'm done with this, we can talk."
"No,"
she interrupted, looked away.
"No, it's better I try to forget."
"I understand." She hugged him briefly, but to Gentry she felt distracted, as if she took him as some sort of animal now, after his brutal display of violence. She clearly just wanted to get away from him and all this madness. Without another word, she climbed into the driver's seat of the car, and he got up onto the hood. The painkiller she'd given him while he slept provided some relief. Even so, climbing the wall was pure agony for a man with such a savage wound in his abdomen, to say nothing of his wrist, leg, and ribcage. Gentry slid over the top of the stone wall, hung his feet down, dropped into soft grass, and heard the little four-door back away and turn around in the road. Court looked down at his watch. It was 7:40 a.m. The heavy fog totally obscured the chateau. All he could see was the beginning of an apple orchard in front of him. Bright red fruit lay on the ground under row after row of small trees with narrow trunks. Court checked his gear one last time, took a deep breath to control his aches and pains, and began running through the orchard and into the deep gray mist. Chapter 33.
"Shut it down," Regal said.
The two Frenchmen who'd been staring at the bank of monitors in the library for 12 hours straight did as they were told. They began flipping switches from left to right, turning off the images from the infrared cameras around the property. Lloyd appeared behind them all in the library's doorway and asked, "What are you doing?" Regal answered,
"Infrared cameras are for the night, Lloyd. It is no longer night."
"You said he'd come at night."
"I did, yes."
"But he's still coming, right?"
"It does not appear so,"
answered Regal the hunter, his voice tinged with both confusion and dejection.
"We've got 15 minutes to get a body for Felix. What the fuck are we going to do?"
Regal turned to the younger American.
"We have a helicopter overhead and over 100 men and women looking for him. We have 30 guns right here at the chateau waiting on him. We've shot him, we've stabbed him, we've sent him down a mountain, off a bridge. We've killed his friends, we've bled him dry. What else can we do?"
Just then, the text voice chirped over the walkie-talkie feature of both men's phones.
"We have a couple of problems."
"What is it?"
asked Regal.
"The Bolivians have left the contest. They just called from Paris to tell us they quit."
"Good riddance," snapped Lloyd.
"And the Kazakhs are not checking in."
Regal lifted his phone from his belt.
"They never check in."
"The Saudis' chopper can't find them on the road."
Lloyd spoke into his phone now.
"We would have heard gunshots if they were in battle with the gray man. Don't worry about it. The bastards probably ran off like the Bolivians."
Lloyd and Regal walked back up the 2 flights of stairs to the 3rd floor. Both men were dead tired, but neither would allow the other to see any sign of weakness. Instead, they argued over what could have been done differently and what last-minute actions could still be taken. They entered the control room and immediately noticed Felix standing by the window, his mobile to his ear. After a few seconds, the thin black man in the suit disconnected his call and turned to face the room. He had not spoken a word in hours.
"Gentlemen, I am sorry to say your time is up."
Lloyd stormed up to him, wild-eyed.
"No! We've got 10 minutes! You've got to give us a little more time! You saw him fall into the water! We fucking killed him! We just need time to find whatever ditch he crawled into to die! Tell Abu Bakr you saw him fall!"
"Your instructions were to produce a body. You have failed in this undertaking. I have reported this to my president. I am sorry. It is my duty. You understand."
Regal's broad shoulders dropped, and he looked away. He could not believe the gray man, if alive, had not come to save the kids. Lloyd said,
"Any second he'll turn up. Abu Bakr doesn't have to sign over the contract until he leaves office in another hour."
"It is now a moot point. I notified the president of your progress, or should I say lack of progress. He signed your competitor's contract while we were on the phone together. I've been instructed to return to Paris to await further instruction."
Regal nodded slowly. He said to Felix,
You can fly back with the French engineers. They will be leaving for Paris within the hour.
Felix nodded in polite appreciation.
I am sorry this endeavor did not work out for you. I appreciate your professionalism and hope our interests will coincide again someday.
The German and the Nigerian bowed to one another. Ignoring the American, Felix left the room to ready himself for departure. Regal looked to the tech.
Notify the teams. It's over. They have failed. Let them know I will contact their agency heads this afternoon to discuss some sort of consolation.
The tech did as he was told. Then he flipped off the monitors in front of him. He pulled off his headphones and laid them on the table slowly. He ran his hands through his long hair. The three men remaining in the control room each sat alone with their own thoughts for a few minutes. The morning light shone through the window, seemed to crawl across the floor towards them, taunting them with their failure. They were to have their man by sunrise, and sunrise now mocked them. Lloyd looked down to his watch.
It's 5 till 8. No sense in putting it off any longer.
Kurt Regal was looking into the bottom of his coffee cup. He was exhausted. Distractedly, he asked,
"Putting what off?"
"The obligations on the second floor."
"Sir Donald, you mean?"
Regal straightened.
"I'll handle it. You'd take all day."
Lloyd shook his head. "Not just Don. All of them. All four." Regal looked up from his chair.
"What are you talking about? You want to kill the woman? The children?"
"I told Gentry if he didn't show, they would die. He didn't show." Don't look so goddamn surprised.
"He didn't show. That means he's dead. Why punish a dead man, you idiot?"
"He should have tried harder."
Lloyd pulled the silver automatic from his hip and let it hang in his hand by his side.
"Get out of the way, Regal. This is still my operation."
"Not for much longer."
There was menace in the big German's voice.
"Be that as it may," Lloyd said, "I still have a job to do, and I don't see you stopping me. You can act all sanctimonious about that family, but you know they could identify us, identify this place. They've got to die."
He pushed past Regal and stepped into the hallway. On the tech's desk, Sir Donald Fitzroy's phone rang. Lloyd reappeared in the doorway instantly. The young technician quickly sat back down and slipped his headphones back over his ears. Felix stepped back into the room, curious, his attaché in his hand and a camel-colored raincoat over his arm. The tech put the call through the overhead speakers. Lloyd said,
"Yes?"
"Good morning, Lloyd. How are things?"
"You are too late, Court. We lost the contract, which means you have failed. I don't need the leverage of the Fitzroys anymore. I was just heading downstairs to put some bullets into them. Want to listen in? You need them alive more than ever now."
Lloyd smiled.
"Oh, really? And why is that?"
"Life insurance."
"Yeah, Court. I watched you fall off that bridge last night. I don't know where the hell you are, but you are in no position to
forget about the contract with Abu Bakr. Don't worry about your boss firing you. Put out of your mind Regal's henchmen showing up at your door some cold night. Ignore all your future troubles. Right now, the only danger in your world is me."
"How are you a danger to—"
"Because I'm heavily armed, I'm royally pissed, and I'm right outside."
In the control room, there was a silent flurry of activity. Regal moved to the window quickly, pushed the lace curtains aside with a fingertip. He scanned the heavy mist over the back lawn. The tech lurched across the desk to his handheld radio and frantically began whispering the news to the guards on the property. Felix pulled out his mobile and charged into the hallway, thumbing buttons as he moved. Only Lloyd did not flinch. He stood as if his feet were stuck to the floor.
"You're bluffing. You just expect me to let the Fitzroys go because you say you are outside? What kind of idiot do you take me for?"
"An idiot with an expiration date. And I assume Laurent Group's Grim Reaper is listening in. Regal, The same goes for you. You brush a hair on the heads of those kids or Mrs. Fitzroy, and you will die in that house.
Regal spoke up. Good morning, Mr. Gentry. If you are outside, why don't you come to the front door? The Lagos contract is lost. Our incentive to kill you has vanished. We've just called off the wet squads. The game is over. If you are really here, why not drop in for coffee?
If you doubt that I'm in the neighborhood, maybe you should try checking in with the four smelly guys in the blue Citroën.
That sank in a moment. Regal did not know what the Kazakhs drove, but the tech anxiously began trying to raise them again. As he did so, receiving no reply, he looked up to his two superiors with eyes of terror. Finally, Regal said,
Most impressive. A man in your condition still able to dispatch four tier-one operators without a shot fired. As I said, we have no quarrel with you any longer. Please come in, and we'll...
You free the Fitzroys and hand over the SAD files, or I swear to God I will murder every last living thing in that house.
Lloyd had been quiet, his hands on his hips, and his sweat-stained shirt sleeves rolled up to his elbows. But now he moved. Storming across the room to the tech's desk, he leaned into the mobile phone's microphone.
Fucking bring it, you gimpy piece of shit! In the meantime, I'm going to take a straight razor to those two stupid little bitches downstairs!
Regal pulled the American lawyer away from the phone, shoved him hard against the stone wall. He leaned in himself, cleared his throat.
Yes, Court. Could you allow us a few moments to discuss your proposal? You know how corporations are. We must call a meeting for everything.
Sure, Regal. I'll check back in a bit. Take your time. No rush.
The phone went dead.
Lloyd screamed to the tech, Get all the teams here, now!
Regal held up his hand to stay the tech. When he spoke, his voice was more reasoned.
For what purpose, Lloyd? The contract is not at stake anymore. The game is over.
But the gray man is still out there!
That's our problem, not Laurent Group's. Mark Laurent will not spend a dime for the foreign kill squads to protect us. There is no more $20 million bounty to be paid out.
Clearly, Lloyd had not thought of that. He shrugged his shoulders.
We don't have to tell the hitters that.
Regal shook his head.
So instead of fighting one wounded man now, you want to piss off Mark Laurent and a half-dozen nations' security services, fight our corporation, and 6 countries later?
I know you are insane, Lloyd.
That's been established. But are you suicidal, too?
The tech was looking back at his two bosses, waiting for instruction. Then he cocked his head to the side, put his hand to his headset.
Wait! All the teams are coming here anyway!
Good, Lloyd said, glad the matter was settled.
Why?
Asked Regal.
Felix contacted them. He's offering $20 million cash from Ebu Bakr to the team that kills the gray man.
Perfect! Shouted Lloyd.
How soon till they...
Not perfect! Said the tech.
He's told them to kill anyone who gets in their way, including the other teams, including us. They're going to fight each other for Gentry's head right here at the chateau.
Kurt Regal did not hesitate.
Pull all the Minsk guards inside the building. Alert Serge and Elaine and the 3 UK guards. We must defend these walls against all threats. The Grey Man or the kill squads.
The tech looked up at Regal.
The Libyans will be here in moments. The Saudis are overhead now!
Regal looked out the window a final time.
Call Laurent Group Paris. Have an evacuation chopper scramble to get us out of here. Then raise the kill teams. Tell them we can still work together. Tell them Court is outside. Tell them we won't let anyone in the castle. They need to kill him before he gets in.
The tech spun in his chair and placed the call to the Home Office. Gentry had no intention of calling Regal back. Every second he delayed his attack on the chateau was another second the defenders could ready themselves, search the grounds for him, bring in more reinforcements. And it was more time they could use to kill the girls. No, he had to move now. The grounds were awash in the morning's light as he lay in the apple orchard at the back of the property. Through the gray mist, he could just make out a faint outline of a large, looming structure on a rise ahead of him. He'd covered a quarter mile since he'd dropped over the wall, and he was still easily 200 yards from Chateau Laurent. The open ground in front of him was his biggest concern. Once he broke free from the coverage of the tree line and the thick fog hanging in the air, he would be completely exposed. Also, there was a helicopter flying circles high in the air. He could not see it, but its beating rotors announced its presence above the property. This would be hard enough even without his multitude of injuries, but regardless of his poor personal circumstance, he knew there was no more time to waste. Court rose to his knee pads, then slowly up to a crouch. He felt blood on his left leg and knew it was again draining freely from the knife wound. The heavy dose of speed he'd introduced to his bloodstream would increase his blood loss significantly. "Fuck it," he said aloud. He unslung the M4 and hefted it in his arms. He stood, then ran forward with every ounce of strength he possessed. As soon as the tech alerted the security cordon around the chateau that the gray man was outside, Serge rushed from the kitchen into the library and flipped the monitors back on. He knew the infrared cameras would pick up anyone hidden in the vapor. Intently, he stared at one display and then the next. Back and forth, he scanned. Soon, his eyes locked on an image. His hand lunged for the radio on his desk. He broadcast to all elements in the chateau.
"Movement in the back! Movement in the back! One man, and he's coming fast!"
Lloyd came over the radio.
"Where? Where the fuck is he?"
"Coming through the orchard! Mon Dieu! He can run!"
"Where in the orchard?" screamed Lloyd over the radio.
"He's running right up the middle!"
The spotter in the tower broke in over the same channel. His thick Belarusian-accented voice was calm, the antithesis of Lloyd's shriek.
"I do not have a target. We do not see any... Wait. Yes. One man coming fast. We'll take him."
Maurice had left Gentry an impressive array of equipment, but Maurice was decidedly old school, and the gear Court was forced to use was not ideal to his needs. The Colt rifle in his hands wore iron sights. There was no scope or holographic sight like the high-tech wizardry Gentry preferred on his weapons. As he broke through the mist, the chateau forming clearer in front of him with each labored footfall of his sprint, he made out the turret of the tower above. He knew this would be a sniper's hide, and he knew this man would have the best skill and the best scope and the best rifle and the best chance to put a stop to Court's ridiculous one-man assault. So the gray man raised his rifle to his shoulder, still at a dead run. Targeted fire with the iron sights while running was impossible. His goal was to simply pour as much lead as he could at the tower to keep his enemy's heads down while he could make it to the building's wall. Court knew there was no one in the house with as much close-quarters battle training or experience as he. He just had to survive long enough to make it to close quarters to have any sort of chance of success. The sniper saw the target shoot out of the fog in front of him. Wisps of vapor swirled in a vortex behind him as he ran. The 30-year-old Belarusian adjusted his aim and placed his crosshairs on the sprinting man's chest. He brought his finger to the trigger for a quick center-mass shot. He noticed body armor under the tactical vest and lowered the buttstock of the big Dragunov a millimeter to move the crosshairs up to the sprinting man's forehead. As his fingertip began to press on the tight trigger, he sensed more than saw his target's primary weapon rise in front of him, flashes from the muzzle of the weapon and the cracks of rifle fire. The sniper heard pops and explosions in the stone and wood of the turret, and smoky dust filled the air around him as high-speed metal-jacketed rounds collided with hundreds-year-old masonry. His spotter cried out to his left, but the sniper was disciplined. He did not remove his cheek from the rifle. He did not remove his eye from his scope. Confidently, he pulled the trigger at the man storming towards him.
Chapter 34.
Gentry had fired almost an entire 30-round magazine at the tower looming above him as he closed on it as fast as possible. He wanted to finish the magazine with a couple of more accurately placed shots towards the tower. So he brought the black rifle up to eye level in front of him to make an attempt to get some sort of a sight picture through the round ghost ring sight on the gun's carry handle.
Just as he did so, the rifle slammed back into his face, ripped out of his hands, and flipped up through the air.
Court ran on, empty-handed. After no more than 4 or 5 steps across the wet lawn, his face burning from the blow of his buttstock below his eye, he realized his M4 must have been hit by a round from a high-powered rifle. Though he'd lost his primary weapon behind him, he understood the gun had saved his life, deflecting a sniper's bullet to his head. Without a loss of stride, he reached down and pulled the squat MP5 submachine gun from its resting place on his chest. He fired again at the tower, now no more than 100 yards away. The MP5 was about as effective as a fly swatter for a sprinting man covering open ground and engaging a tiny, distant window without a sight picture, but he hoped it would at least keep some heads down. The sniper had seen the running man reel from the impact of his shot, and then he lifted his head away from the scope to attend to his partner. The spotter had taken a piece of stone masonry to his face. His glasses were broken, and he was bleeding from the forehead, but he was coherent and not badly hurt. Just then, more gunfire erupted from the back garden. With surprise, the Belarusian sniper looked back down and saw the man he was sure he had just put a bullet through continue his charge. From the reports of the gun in his hand, the man in the tower knew the gray man had switched to a 9mm submachine gun. Quickly, he sat back at the table behind the Dragunov, took up his position behind the scope in under 2 seconds. Suddenly, new cracks of rifle fire erupted, this time from behind him on the other side of the chateau. For a moment, he did not understand what was going on, until the voice of one of his countrymen below came over the radio on the table.
"It's the Libyans! They're at the front gate! Tower, take them out!"
Reluctantly, the sniper lifted the big Dragunov from the table and took it to the front portal of the tower. The gray man was someone else's problem now. He needed to engage the distant targets, the Libyans. The gray man was no longer distant. He was close. Just outside the sniper's tower, the black Eurocopter hovered low above the roof's walkway. 4 heavily armed Saudi operators in tactical gear poured out and dropped the 6 feet to the flat eastern roof. They ignored the gunfight now raging at the front of the building. Instead, they all took up positions behind the decorative battlements overlooking the back garden and the lone man running towards them over open ground. As Gentry closed on his objective, he redirected his fire from the tower above the chateau to a first-floor window where bright muzzle flashes flickered. Gentry emptied his first magazine at the window in front of him. The walls around the window pocked, granite snapped off in dusty chunks, glass shattered, and the lace draperies whipped left and right as a few lucky shots from Court's rifle found their mark through the space. It was difficult firing at a full sprint, impossible to accurately aim. Court saw no more muzzle flashes from the window, but instead noticed the sleek black Eurocopter above and in front of him, and the men who leapt from it.
Fuck!
He was still 70 yards from cover. He pushed his legs even harder to get as close to the chateau as possible before the men now exiting the black chopper could get in position to open up on him. Here on the flat lawn, he'd be a sitting duck to aimed fire. Gentry pulled a fragmentation grenade off his vest as he ran, yanked the pin out with his teeth, and let the spoon fly. A large, blonde-haired figure appeared in a window on the 3rd floor directly in front of him, raised a handgun, and shot through the glass. Court dove forward at the wet, green grass to avoid the fire, landed on his right shoulder, and executed a forward roll. As he came out of the roll, he rose to his feet. His running and his somersault had given his body an incredible amount of momentum, momentum he used to throw the grenade as high and as far as he could. From 45 yards away, the potato-sized bomb whizzed through the air in an arc, rose over the edge of the parapets, and exploded, just missing the Eurocopter, which escaped into the sky, fleeing from the fight as fast as possible. The blast above the Saudis' heads killed one man outright and injured one more in the neck and back. The other 2 had found cover in time, but they'd missed their opportunity to get an open shot on their target on the lawn. At the front of the house, 2 Belarusians and 2 Libyans were already dead. The guards from Minsk were killed not far from the front gate. They'd been running back to the safety of the chateau when the van load of operators from Tripoli busted through the ironwork, the Middle Eastern men firing their Scorpion machine pistols from the moving vehicle. The two Libyans were felled as the van screeched to a stop in the gravel drive. The sniper in the tower took out the operator in the front passenger seat with a round to the face, and the first man out of the sliding back took 3 AK rounds from the only pair of Belarusians still outside the chateau. The two remaining Libyans killed the men on the driveway and closed on the front door to the chateau. They poured automatic fire from their Scorpions into the windows on either side, kept disciplined distance between one another, and shouted calls for cover as they reloaded and repositioned. Number two fired half a magazine at each of the two hinges of the heavy oaken door and then kicked it open. As he reloaded, it crashed into the building in front of him, and he caught a double tap from a Northern Irish guard in the foyer, spinning the Libyan dead to the ground. The last living Libyan answered the Ulsterman with his Scorpion. Blood and tissue splattered across the white wall behind the man in the foyer as he went down. Regal had never seen anything like it. The gray man had been in his sights. He wore a dark brown shirt with bloodstains on the waist, a drop-leg pistol holster on his right hip, and a magazine subload on his left. A black vest and a submachine gun adorned his chest. His head was shaved, and even at 50 yards, Kurt thought he could discern a fierceness in the eyes. When Regal drew his handgun and aimed it at the running man, he knew it was a long-distance shot for a pistol, but for a trained target shooter like the German, he should not have missed. But the running man had dropped just below his rounds at exactly the right time, rolled, risen back to his feet, and hurled a grenade into the air. Instinctively, Regal dove to the ground next to the tech's desk, presuming the bomb was meant for him. The detonation blasted just above him on the roof. He heard shouts and screaming through the window now, and he quickly regained his position to get a few more shots off at Gentry as he closed. But when he looked back out the window, the gray man was gone. And now there was no way to stop him from entering the building. Incredible. Just as Gentry had promised over the phone the evening before, the prey had become the predator. Court slammed his back against the wall of the chateau and reloaded his weapon with a fresh magazine from his thigh rig. 2 stories directly above him was the big blonde man with the pistol. Above that man would be the shooters from the helicopter. He was reasonably certain he'd thin their rank some, but he held no illusions that he'd eliminated the threat on the roof. To his left and right, there were windows waist high. Glass shattered from Gentry's HK made them dangerous to enter without prepping them first. To his left were steps up to the main back door. Around the corner to his left was the front drive and some sort of battle raging. And to his right was the long back wall lined with windows, and then a small set of doors. In a crouch, he rushed along the wall, shoulder scraping the stone to stay out of view of the shooters above him. He was near the door when it opened outwards. As it swung open, he raised his weapon to fire a burst through the wood, but hesitated at the last second. What if it was one of the Fitzroys? Court recognized he was not the best man to undertake a rescue operation. He had a tendency to shoot anything that moved in a combat situation. Now, he had to take that extra moment to ID his target. A head peered around the edge of the door to him. It was big and Slavic, and when he saw the barrel of a rifle past the door's edge, Gentry satisfied himself of the validity of his target. He sent 8 rounds through the door as he ran towards it. It was set to lock when it closed, but the doorstop of freshly dead goon kept it open for Gentry as he entered a darkened hallway. At the first sound of gunfire on the back lawn, Claire and Kate Fitzroy ran to their sleeping mummy and shook and screamed at her to wake. Once on her feet, Elise stumbled. The girls steadied her with both hands as they led her to the other side of the bedroom where Grandpa Donald sat upright on the 4-poster bed. Claire relayed to all that Jim wanted them under the bed, and Grandpa Donald agreed. Mummy fell back asleep face down on the hard wood. Claire and Kate huddled together in fear, peeking under the bedrunner towards the door to the hallway, while Grandpa Donald remained above them.
After a loud explosion on the roof 2 stories above, Grandpa Donald called out to the guard.
McSpadden! McSpadden!
Claire saw the boots of the Scottish guard move into the room. She heard the conversation above her, though she didn't understand all of the words.
Lad, best you do your runner now, but be a good chap and leave us a gun.
Fuck you, Fitzroy. It's too late to run.